Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this evening's May 2009 edition of Science News Update. I'm your host, Jim Campanella. First, let me start off by saying I have almost nothing to say about the swine flu pandemic. We've had talking heads from around the world filling us with accurate and inaccurate predictions and commentary, and I simply refuse to add to that morass of information. My only comment is very oblique, and it is this. The so-called pandemic has been a long time in coming. I was not at all surprised at its emergence, and I suspect most microbiologists just nodded their heads in simple resignation. It has been predicted by many epidemiologists for years. I will simply refer you to the text, The Coming Plague, Newly Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance, by Dr. Laurie Garrett. It was written back in 1994 and is still as important a text today in understanding sporadic epidemics as it was 15 years ago. You could pick it up for pretty cheaply on Amazon if you're curious. That's all. Let's get down to less bone-chilling subjects. Several months back, you will remember that there was a wonderful David Brin story on the sofa, narrated quite skillfully by Julie Davis. The name of the story was Temptation, and it concerned genetically uplifted dolphins on an alien planet. It was, to say the least, a very cool story. The dolphins have amazing abilities in Brin's uplift saga, but it is amazing sometimes how truth is even more incredible than fiction. In the most recent issue of the Journal of Experimental Biology from May 2009, there is a research paper from Dr. Sam Ridgway's lab at the U.S. Navy Marine Mammal Program, along with his colleagues at the University of California. This new paper suggests that dolphins have even more mind-blowing abilities than we ever guessed. The title of the paper is innocent enough. Dolphins maintain cognitive performance during 72 to 120 hours of continuous auditory vigilance. But what exactly does that actually mean? Well, first of all, let me tell you, as a parent of young children, I am still not getting enough sleep per night as I should. I have covered this ground in previous podcasts, so I will not go into it, but I have not gotten a night of unbroken sleep in almost a year now since my son was born. I have no doubt that you all know how difficult it is to function after a few missed nights of sleep. However, it seems that dolphins have a clever trick for overcoming sleep deprivation. In that physiology article, Dr. Sam Ridgway explains that dolphins are able to send half of their brains to sleep while the other half remains conscious. What's more, the mammals seem to be able to remain continually vigilant for sounds for days on end. Ridgway's paper examines whether the dolphins' unrelenting auditory vigilance tires them out and takes a toll on the animal's other senses. Ridgway and his team set about testing two dolphins' acoustic and visual vigilance over a five-day period to find out how well they functioned after days without a break. Ridgway and his colleagues trained two dolphins to respond to a 1.5-second beep sounded randomly against a background of 0.5-second beeps every 30 seconds. Ridgway explains that the sounds were low enough for the dolphins to barely notice them as they swam through their enclosure, but the animals sprang into action every time they heard the 1.5-second tone, even after listening to the sounds for up to 5 days without a break. Their auditory vigilance remained as sharp as it had been 5 days earlier. And just as a side note, why does this sound like dolphin torture to me? I know if somebody did something like that to me, I'd be homicidal at the end of 5 days. I guess dolphins are much more forgiving. Anyway, that was just the first part of the testing and training. Next, they designed a visual stimulus to test the dolphins' vigilance while they continued listening to the repetitive beeps. Knowing that dolphins' binocular vision is very limited because their eyes are situated on opposite sides of their heads, the researchers trained one of the dolphins to recognize two shapes, either three horizontal red bars or one vertical green bar, with her right eye, before training her to recognize the same shapes with her left eye. The researchers reasoned that if half of her brain was asleep during testing, the dolphin would only see the shapes through the eye connected to the conscious half of the brain. But they were a little surprised when they began training the dolphin's left eye. She already recognized the shapes, even though her left eye had not seen them previously. Ridgway explains that the information must be transferred between the two brain hemispheres, and he suspects that the dolphin's interhemispheric commissures, which connect the two halves, may actually be transferring the visual information. This is a surprise in dolphins. And this is something that happens in humans who do have binocular vision, but nobody thought that it would occur in dolphins who lack stereoscopic vision. Now, having trained both dolphins to recognize the shapes, the hard part began. They started monitoring and rewarding the dolphins continually over a 5-day period while testing the animals' responses to both sound and visual stimuli. Incredibly, even after 5 days of listening to the 1.5-second beeps among those 0.5-second beeps in the background, the dolphins were still responding as accurately as they had done at the beginning of the experiment. The team also enticed the dolphins into a bay at night where they could be shown the horizontal and vertical bar shapes, and they found that the dolphins were as sharp at the end of the 120-hour experiment as they had been at the beginning. And when the team checked the dolphins' blood for physical signs of sleep deprivation, they couldn't find any. After 5 days of unbroken vigilance, the dolphins were in much better shape than the scientists were. Well, now you begin to get the idea of why the U.S. Navy is so interested in training these amazing animals for use in combat situations. As you can see, they would be better at long-term vigilance than any human could ever be. I refer you to the second-rate George C. Scott movie from the 1970s, Day of the Dolphin. To anyone who loves dolphins and thrillers, it's actually a pretty good movie. And no, as far as I know, dolphins still can't talk, no matter how much tutelage they have. Onward and upward. You know, it's odd sometimes the way my life seems to reflect these odd little science stories that I bring you. I have a 36-month-old daughter right now. As one of my older colleagues with grown children once said, quote, "Kids at that age are basically wild animals. You just have to wait them out until they are socialized," unquote. Unfortunately, I have witnessed that my colleague was correct. My daughter is essentially a small wild animal whom we are continually in the process of trying to tame. As any of you with children know, the most difficult thing to deal with at that young age is the public tantrum. At home, your child can scream and rant as much as they want when they don't get what they want. But in public, at a restaurant, or a store, or a church, well, that's an entirely different matter. You deal with it as best you can with a combination of threats, entreaties, and promises. But there's no way to ever get out of it cleanly. Well, it turns out that other primates have just as much of a problem dealing with this issue as humans do. Dr. Stuart Semple of Roehampton University in London reported a study of rhesus monkeys in March in the Proceedings of the Royal Academy. It turns out that rhesus macaque mothers are about twice as likely to let a howling infant have its way during very public tantrums than during more private moments. If a rhesus baby does not get its way, for example, if feeding is cut short, then the baby will let out a shriek that is apparently quite unpleasant. Dr. Semple calls this high-pitched grating scream, quote-unquote, pretty harsh stuff, which is probably an understatement given that he is writing for a scientific journal, and we are always taught to not exaggerate in our scientific writing. I try to make that clear to my own graduate students who ignore me and continually throw around superlatives which I am constantly editing into oblivion. Anyway, this is the really interesting part. It seems that if the tantrum takes place in public where the screaming can be heard by other rhesus monkeys, then the onlookers get restless and offended by the screaming. Both the mom and the unhappy baby become 30 times more likely to suffer aggression and attack from a bystander during a crying bout than they would in quiet times. Most of the aggression came from monkeys that weren't close relatives and outranked the mother in the social hierarchy. Relatives proved a bit more tolerant. Depending on who was nearby, the baby's tantrum was appeased with varying levels of success. So, for example, if there were just relatives of the mother and baby nearby, then the baby's luck rose to 53% to get whatever they wanted. But with unrelated onlookers hearing the screaming who outranked the mother in the dominance hierarchy, the babies won the tantrum contest 81% of the time. Wow. Seriously, this is exactly the difference between my kids being at their cousin's house or being out in public with strangers. I never even thought of this before, but there's a serious correlation between how quick we are to appease our own human kids' tantrums. I begin to wonder whether there's not a clear evolutionary reason that humans act this way as well. Imagine being on an airplane for a 6-hour flight and letting a child's tantrum run rampant. By the end of the flight, you would be on the same par as a terrorist hijacker with your fellow travelers. We have socially survived for thousands of years because we quickly quiet our children, when they might be otherwise quieted in a much more violent way by strangers. But much as my imagination runs wild, suggesting a selective advantage in shutting our kids up in public, there are other, more primitive primates that do not do this. The article mentions the Thomas Langur. The babies of langurs throw tantrums as well, but since they tend to take care of each other's children, even unrelated ones, something called alloparenting, there does not seem to be the physical threat there that other langurs may attack the babies. Semple says, quote, "We need to start thinking about communication in more realistic terms," unquote. What he means is that in the real world, communication takes place not just between two people. There's often a whole slew of other listeners who will interact as well. Okay, just to be fair, let me finish this by pointing out something else from Semple's work. It turns out that even mom can get more than a little annoyed at her little darling if given enough unremittent screaming. After analyzing detailed records, Semple found that the rhesus monkey mother's behavior, on average, was 400 times more likely to get aggressive toward her own baby when it was crying than when it wasn't. As one evolutionary biologist I know put it, quote, "Why do you think babies are so damn cute? If they weren't cute as buttons, then the species would have died out after the first few nights of screaming and being woken up at 3 a.m. Their cuteness protects them," unquote. I just wonder whether rhesus monkey moms also think their little darlings are cute. Okay, the last story has to do with a disease which you do not see in the Northern Hemisphere very often, dengue fever. I have an odd interest in dengue fever. I actually have an in-law that got dengue fever. Now, when you hear that someone gets a horrid disease, you usually respond with, "Oh my God, that's dreadful." But in the case of my one brother-in-law, it was more along the lines of, "Oh really, I'm not at all surprised." My wife has told me innumerable stories about her one brother, who growing up literally broke every bone in his body at one time or another. He is what you might call accident-prone. Not that this has ever stopped him from doing whatever he wants. One of my favorite stories my wife tells was when she was a kid. She was biking with her brother and passed a house with a large, seriously nasty dog. The dog was off the leash one day and ran at them as they passed on the street. The dog actually ignored and ran past my future wife, who I am sure was probably quite tasty, and attacked her brother quite selectively. That is the kind of life he has led. Anyway, several years ago, he stayed with us for a couple of weeks before he was going to work as a teacher in Bolivia for a Catholic missionary organization. He stayed with us while he took some training in New York City with the missionaries. He broke his leg here while playing basketball before he ever actually left the country. It was only a hairline fracture, and he recovered quickly and was back on his feet promptly once he was down south. Well, once in Bolivia, he was on a field trip with a bunch of school kids, and he decided that a swim in a nearby tropical river might be fun. All the kids and teachers were fine, but he succumbed to what later was diagnosed as dengue river fever. In addition, I believe that he picked up a non-communicable form of tuberculosis down there. He's now recovered from both of those, found a lovely wife down there, and has been living a mostly healthy existence back in the States here. Why did I just go on about my purposely unnamed brother-in-law so? Well, you don't meet someone every day who has actually had dengue fever and lived to tell the nasty tale. It is an unpleasant disease. I say it's rare, but only in the north. The disease is carried by mosquitoes, and 40% of the world's population is believed to be at risk from the infection. What's more, previous exposure to other strains of the fever does not confer protection. In fact, subsequent infections are usually worse and can result in a fatal dengue hemorrhagic fever, which you really don't want to know the details of. At any rate, there is no vaccine for this disease. And since there is no vaccine, scientists have had to turn to more creative ways of dealing with the problem. In this month's issue of the Journal of Experimental Biology, Dr. Scott O'Neill and Elizabeth McGraw of the University of Queensland in Australia and their colleagues examine one of the alternatives to reducing the number of dengue fever sufferers worldwide, Essentially, they want to make the mosquitoes who pass along the disease sick themselves. It turns out that the bacterium Wolbachia pipientis shortens insect lifespans in general. The researchers infected the primary mosquito vector of dengue virus, Aedes aegypti, with this disease. The hope was that the microbe's ability to shorten lifespan and spread through host populations by actually living within cells would mean that it could be used as a biocontrol agent to reduce dengue virus transmission. So remember, the goal was to make the mosquitoes sick so they would be less likely to bite and infect humans. Well, that didn't exactly happen. The insects did die at an earlier age, but something unexpected occurred at the same time. Contrary to their expectations, the researchers found that the bacterial infection actually seemed to increase metabolic activity and rate, and that these effects were relatively consistent over the insect's entire lifespan. The authors say, quote, "The results do not fit a standard model of bacterial pathogenesis in insects, and instead may reveal additional physiological changes induced by infection, such as either increased hunger or defects in the nervous system," unquote. The researchers give three possible reasons why the infection made the insects more active and not less. First, the insects were living fast and dying young. Second, the insects were hungrier and consumed more energy in their constant search for food. Or third, the bacteria somehow affected the insects' tissues to change their behavior and increase their metabolic rate. McGraw and O'Neill suspect that it's probably the last explanation that's the most likely. Although the authors insist they've proved their point, I'm a little skeptical. Okay, so they show that the mosquito's lifespan is reduced by this bacterial infection, but you see a bit of a problem here. Okay, so they live half as long, but they bite just as many people because they're twice as active. There just seems to be a certain level of pointlessness to this line of study. But perhaps it's just me who sees this as silly. The Aussie group will continue this line of research, and I wish them every luck. I mean, their hearts are certainly in the right place. They still hope that a better understanding of how the Wolbachia infection affects the skeeters will eventually help to control the disease vector. Well, that's all from me for now. Thanks for listening. As always, take care, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.